Accession number 8736, room number 31.
Lord Harding, tape 31. Could I ask you now, Lord Harding, about Malaya? What was the situation when you arrived in the summer of 1949?
Well, perhaps I'd better start by explaining what the structure was, the top structure. And at the top, as far as British interests were concerned, was an organisation called the British Defence Coordination Committee. And that was presided over by Malcolm MacDonald, who was the Commissioner General for the whole of the Far East. And it comprised the Commissioner General and the three Commanders-in-Chiefs, the Naval and the Air Commander-in-Chief and the Army Commander-in-Chief. So that was my first top responsibility as a member of the BDCC, as it was called, who were responsible for British defence policy, strategic policy, and which means bringing in the political side, of course, throughout the Far East. That's from Burma to Japan. And then underneath that, there was the three commanders-in-chiefs were responsible, of course, for their own three services. And my responsibility as commander-in-chief of the Far East Land Forces was in regard to all the British troops in Malaya, in Singapore, and in Hong Kong, with a watching brief over any requirements in Borneo, and liaison with the French in Indochina. The actual situation in Malaya was that there had been a communist insurrection aimed at seizing power over the whole of Malaya. And their plan was to seize and control and govern a certain area of the country and then claim that they were an independent government and expand from there. And their tactics were of guerrilla action, primarily directed against the police. The structure, the political and administrative structure in Malaya was a high commissioner, who was at that time Gurney, with a staff in Kuala Lumpur. And then the attempt to set up a federation of Malaya had broken down, and there was the various states were still in the hands of their sultans, various titles that they had, each with a British resident as an advisor. And the same applied to Sarawak, Brunei, and Borneo, where there were British governors. There was a British governor in Singapore, and then there were British governors in North Borneo, in Sarawak, where I think he was called a resident, and there was a British resident in Brunei, which was still in the hands of the Sultan of, still is in the hands of the Sultan of Brunei. In Hong Kong, there was a British governor and a British general in command, in direct command of the British troops in Hong Kong and the New Territories. And in Singapore, there was a governor, British governor, again with a British general in command of the British troops in Malaya, in Singapore, the Singapore Island. And the British troops in Malaya were under the command of another Major General who was directly in touch or worked with the High Commissioner Gurney. And I happened to have known him before. He was a chap called Charles Boucher, who was an ex-Gurkha officer. I didn't know the general in Singapore, but I soon got to know him, called Dunlop. And the general in Hong Kong was Bob Manster, whom I had met before, but didn't know well. He was a lieutenant general at that time. He was an ex-gunner. And in Borneo, North Borneo, Sarawak, Brunei, there was a resident and no British troops. And there were no British troops either in Sarawak or North Borneo. But in North Borneo, I think there was a British officer as a military assistant or advisor to the governor. So that was the sort of general setup. And the main interest, of course, at that time was the emergency in Malaya, which had broken out, I don't know, about a year before, and in which not much progress had been made by the security forces. So the real problem was to deal with the situation in Malaya and at the same time keep in touch, of course, with Malaya and Malaya and Singapore are pretty closely connected. That was the main problem, but there was a secondary problem, which was the defense of Hong Kong. Because at that time, when I arrived there, the Chinese communists had come south of the Yangtze, and there were grave fears that eventually they would launch an attack on Hong Kong. So there were two problems, really. There was to deal with the insurrection in Malaya, which was primarily the responsibility, of course, of the High Commissioner and his staff, with the general there working with him, and also to build up or prepare Hong Kong, as far as you could prepare it, for defense against a major assault by the Chinese. And, well, I suppose they're about of equal priority, but probably more higher priority to the Malayan situation. I started, of course, to study the situation, and I kept in touch with my two other commanders-in-chiefs, and talked and discussed the whole thing with them, and we had lengthy discussions in the BDCC with Malcolm MacDonald, who was in overall charge of policy and strategy in the Far East. And I wasn't very happy about the way the situation was developing in Malaya. I thought the Chinese communist terrorists were making a good deal of progress and getting more and more control. And there was always the danger of intervention from the north through Siam, or as it was then called. And so the thing to do was to study that situation and decide what was best to do. As far as the troops were concerned, I wasn't at all happy from about the reports that I got about standard of training, jungle training, which is an expert business in itself. It's quite different from desert warfare. It's quite different from European warfare. It's a thing of its own. The jungle is impenetrable. You can't live in it. It's full of traps, and it's an ideal guerrilla country. And there was considerable doubt, of course, about the extent to which the Chinese workers on the rubber estates and in the tin mines were going to be subverted by the communist terrorists. And the supply of rubber and tin from Malaya to Singapore was, of course, of tremendous importance to the British industrial and defense requirements. And so that was of special importance. And this, I think, was very, very much impressed on one as you went round the country and saw the difficulties and the problems that the rubber planters and the tin miners were having in maintaining the security of their activities and their own personal safety and the safety of their families.
Had there been many incidents against them before you arrived?
There have been a certain number, I think, yes. There have been a number. I don't know how many. I can't remember how many, but there had been some. And, of course, they are very isolated and exposed. And you may find a rubber plantation with the planter and his small headquarters and staff, so what I would call his headquarters, his family and his staff, right in the middle of the jungle or rubber plantations, without any good road access. And there were ambushes on the roads. The police didn't seem to be in control. And I wasn't quite sure about the whole policy. And obviously, one thing took on a mile, and that was that there were not the police were unable to get the situation under control, and there were not enough British troops. There was a small Malayan force, a Malay regiment, which was neither strong nor very effective. There weren't anything like enough British troops to make certain of getting the defeating the communist terrorist organization. So that was one thing. There were two things. The strength of the British troops, well, the overall strength and efficiency of the security forces, by which I mean the police and the armed forces. The training and equipment of the troops in support of, working with the police, and particularly their training, of course, in jungle act warfare against guerrilla against guerrillas. And fighting against guerrillas is a very different thing from fighting against a regular army. They're very elusive, they're very fanatical, and you can't really, what I call, bring them to battle. They work in small groups, they knew the country, they're very mobile, lived on the country, and they had, generally speaking, I think, my assessment was, as far as I remember at that time, that they had, either from sympathy or from fear, mostly from fear, widespread support of the civil population, the Chinese elements in the civil population. The Chinese were the most numerous, more numerous than the Malays. So it was a pretty complicated situation and problem. And I thought the important thing was, in other words, I came to the conclusion after a time that not only were the police not as strong or efficient as they need to be, but there was also a lack of no sense of what I call operational urgency in the civil administration. And of course the administration of the whole country through local sovereigns, little warlords, so to speak, little lords, and British residents. And gradually we evolved a system whereby I came to the conclusion, I think probably fairly early on, I wouldn't like to put a date to it, that what was required was to strengthen and make more efficient the police force, to strengthen the army, to chain it up to for its proper requirement, for the requirement that the problem is the situation it had to meet, and also to get all the elements that contribute to a successful campaign against a terrorist organization to work completely and utterly close together. That's to say, the civil administration, the police, and the armed forces. And I wasn't very happy about the way the whole thing was fitted together. And this took quite a lot of time and discussion, of course, to get agreement. But eventually, we got agreement on getting a new chief of police act to build up, to strengthen and make the police more efficient. Actually, it wasn't a great success, the first one. And eventually, when Joel Templer went out there, he was replaced by a more competent and efficient chap. Then there was the need for training, particularly in marksmanship and in jungle, and fighting in the jungle against the guerrillas. And for that, we had set up a jungle training center. And that took quite time to do, in getting authority from the finance required from the War Office. And I remember getting absolutely furious on one occasion because some blinking pundit in the War Office, the villain, questioned the financial aspect of setting up this school of jungle training, and said the classrooms that we'd planned, we had to send plans home, were too large or were the wrong sort or something or other. And I thought that we were the best judges of that. So there were problems, there were difficulties. There was also, there were a lot of problems, really, of various kinds, mainly of people working together. And gradually we came to the conclusion that we had set up security committees, we called them, in each of the provinces, each of the states. They don't call them provinces, they call them states. Johor, Pahang, and so on. So we eventually got agreement that the senior civil servant, the senior soldier, and the senior policeman in each state would form a security committee, and they would be responsible for all the anti-terrorist operations in that state with whatever resources they were allocated. And I had no direct responsibility for the conduct of the campaign against the terrorists, but I was responsible for the morale and efficiency and administration of the British troops. And so there was a certain amount of overlap there, but we worked out all right. And As I said, I wasn't at all happy. I thought there was a complete lack of a sense of operational urgency in the administration in Kuala Lumpur. And so there was a good deal of argument and discussion with the High Commissioner and his staff, and with Matthew MacDonald and his staff, the Foreign Office people in Singapore, Malcolm's staff, and the other two services, because the Air Force were closely concerned with the anti-terrorist operations, and also the Royal Navy for preventing infiltration from patrolling the coastline and so on. There wasn't very much threat of infiltration, but there was some. Well, that's generally speaking the problem. Equipment. There were no armored vehicles. So we eventually got out a squadron, an armored regiment with equipped with ferrets, small armored cars for patrolling, convoying. The railway line was subject to sabotage, and that had to be dealt with. I'm trying to think. Equipment, I said, we got ferrets out for patrols and for escorting convoys, and then the movement of troops was involved a good deal of difficulties, because they're liable to ambush and they're slow moving on the road. So, as an expedient, we produced a lorry which we armored. Fitted with armored platings, which was acted like what is now called a personnel carrier. And of course it was stinking hot inside. And so to try and add a little comfort to the troops when they were incarcerated in these things and being moved from one position to another, there was a slogan was put up inside the armored lorry, "Hell's hotter." But a reminder that they were at least safe from being shot inside. Those are the sort of problems that went on. And then, also, before I went out there, I was heavily lobbied by the doctors, the army, to press for some helicopters for pioneer work for casualty evacuation from the jungle. And this had been a very serious problem right from the beginning of the emergency, because the chap got severely wounded in some remote part of the jungle. Evacuation by stretcher and then by ambulance on the roads that there were was a very difficult problem. So after a good deal of... But this all happened before I went out, actually. I had a lot of argument with the Royal Air Force, and then with the Air Commander-in-Chief when I got there, because they said that the helicopter was not really suited for this sort of work, and they would have to maintain it. It was a very expensive and tricky equipment, piece of vehicle, requiring a lot of maintenance. However, in the end, they did agree to send out a helicopter, the best helicopter that was in use at that time. And so that started the pioneer work of the use of the army using helicopters. I had when I was at Southern Command, I had the idea that helicopters had a useful role to play in army operations, particularly in regard to reconnaissance and communications. And so I did, when I was at Southern Command, run an exercise, on paper exercise, on the ground, but with imaginary helicopters. And I knew that the report of that exercise had been put into a pigeonhole in the War Office and nothing done about it at all. So that always, I had a good deal of of theoretical thinking and discussion about the use of helicopters, primarily for those two purposes, but also possibly for supply. Well, we started and we did build up a technique for casualty evacuation for the jungle, and then it became clear that the helicopter would be an extremely valuable vehicle for introducing the anti-terrorist operations, for the movement of troops, as well as for reconnaissance and supply and communication. And so eventually, after a lot of, again, argument about the costs and the command and the maintenance and so on, the Navy produced the squadron of helicopters, which eventually went out to Malaya. And that was, as far as I was concerned, the beginning of the more extended use of helicopters for army operations, which we developed a step further in Cyprus later on. Yes, and then there was the problem of dealing with the French in Indochina, because from a political strategic point of view, it was obviously very important to the future security of Southeast Asia, which I mean Malaya, Singapore, and the neighboring countries and the islands off there, to put an end to communist penetration and infiltration, both from China in particular, and by indigenous Chinese, and that might spread to Borneo, to Sarawak, to all over the place, and. So the sort of defense, particularly against communist infiltration and terrorist activities of the whole of Southeast Asia, became an important factor in the discussions and decisions of the DDCC. And that led me to visits to Saigon, to the French command there, and eventually, at a later stage, I spent a week in Saigon, in Hanoi, in the Red River Delta, north, and with De La Tassini, who'd come out as the French commander in chief, and so that took up quite a lot of time. And then I used to pay a monthly visit to Hong Kong to discuss the preparations for defending the island, which meant building a new lateral road, a new airfield, tracks up the main tactical features on the frontier between China and the new territory, between new territories and China, rather. And so that was another problem.